The car passing by on the highway slowed to a crawl so the driver could watch. The women and their children fell while the guns stuttered in the September rain. The car accelerated away. The rain slicker men had missed one person, a little girl, slipping sprite-like across the field toward the hidden observer with the cell phone. She rushed across the meadow as fast as the shadow of a cloud. Harper watched, gripping her baby book in both hands, holding her breath, sending out a silent wish. Let her go. Let her get away. But then the girl folded in on herself and tumbled forward and collapsed, and Harper realized it had never been a person at all. The thing racing across the field had been the dress that the naked woman had been holding. The wind had made it dance for a moment, that was all. Now the dance was over. The program cut back to the studio. The newsman stood in front of a widescreen TV, replaying the footage. He kept his back to it and spoke in a smooth, calm voice. Harper couldn't hear what he was saying. Jacob was talking, too, but she couldn't hear what he was saying, either. She spoke over both of them. "Did you think she looked like me?" Jacob said. "What are you talking about?"
"The woman who was hugging the little boy. I thought she looked like me."
The newscaster was saying, "Illustrates the dangers of people who have been infected and who don't seek—" "I didn't notice," Jacob said. His voice was strangled with emotion.
"Jacob, tell me what's wrong."
"I'm sick."
She felt as if she had stood up too quickly,
although she hadn't moved. She perched on the edge of the couch, lightheaded and a little faint.
"You've got a stripe?"
"I've got a fever."
"Okay, but do you have marks on you?"
"It's on my foot. I thought it was a bruise. I dropped a sandbag on my foot yesterday, and I thought it was just a bruise." For a moment he sounded close to crying.
"Oh, Jacob, send me a picture. I want to look at it."
"I don't need you to look at it."
"Please, for me."
"I know what it is."
"Please, Jake."
"I know what it is, and I have a fever. I'm so fucking hot. I'm 101. I'm so hot and I can't sleep. I keep dreaming the blankets are on fire and I jump out of the bed. Are you having those dreams?"
No. Her dreams were much worse than that.
They were so bad she had recently decided to quit sleeping. It was safer staying awake.
"What were you doing with the sandbag?" she asked.
Not because she cared, but because it might calm him to talk about something besides infection. "I had to go back to work. I had to risk it. Risk contaminating other people. That's the position you've put me in."
"What are you talking about? I don't understand."
"If I just disappeared, people would wonder where I was. They might come by the house and find you. The price of your life is other lives. You've made a potential murderer out of me."
"No, Jacob, we've covered this.
Until the scale is visible on your body, you aren't infectious. Almost everyone agrees on that. And even then, you can only pass it through skin-on-skin contact." "I don't think you're a mass murderer just yet."
"So what about the sandbag?"
"They had everyone in public works up on the Piscataqua Bridge the other day, taking orders from the National Guard, building a gun emplacement to shoot any diseased motherfuckers who might try and drive through the new checkpoint." "Why are we talking about the fucking bridge?"
"I need you to send me a picture of the mark on your foot," she said. And her tone was firmer now, her nurse voice.
"I think it's in my head, too. Sometimes it's like there are pins pricking in my brain, like there are 100 little needles in there."
That stopped her.
It was the first thing he said that sounded not just hysterical, but crazy.
When she went on, her voice was calm and certain.
"No.
Jacob, no.
It does eventually coat the myelin in the brain and nerves. But it wouldn't happen until well after you had dragon scale all over your body." "I fucking know. I fucking know what you did to me. You killed the both of us, and our baby, too, to satisfy your ego."
"What are you talking about?"
"You knew it was dangerous to work in that hospital, but you wanted to feel important. You have this thing in you, Harper. You have this need to be hugged. You seek out chances to be with people who are hurting so you can stick a band-aid on them and get some cheap, easy affection. That's why you became a school nurse. It's easy to squeeze a kiss out of a kid with a scraped knee.
Kids will love anyone who gives them a penny lollipop and a band-aid for their boo-boo. It left her breathless, the spoiled rage she heard in his voice. She had never heard him that way before. They were desperate, Harper said. They needed every nurse they could get. The hospital was calling in retired nurses who were 85 years old. I couldn't just sit at home and watch people die on TV and not do anything. We have to decide, he said, almost sobbed. I do not want to fucking burn to death or be hunted down and butchered in a field begging for my life. If you aren't sleeping, that could explain a high temperature. We don't know you're sick. Sometimes fever indicates onset of infection, but not always. Not even mostly. I didn't get a fever. Now I want you to send me a photo of your foot. There was a clumsy knocking sound, muffled bumps, then a click. The sound of the camera app taking it still. 15 seconds passed with no other noise than his labored, miserable breathing. A photo came through of his dark, bare foot, stretched out on some industrial-looking carpet. The top of the foot was a single bloody abrasion. Jake, she said. What is that? I tried to scrape it off, he said. His voice was almost sullen. I had a bad moment. I sandpapered it. Do you have any other stripes on you? I know what it looked like before I went crazy, he said. You don't scrape at this stuff, Jake. That's like scraping a match on a matchbook. Leave it alone. She lowered her phone and looked at the photo again. I want to see more stripes before you make up your mind you've got dragon scale. In the early going, it can be difficult to tell the difference between a bruise and a stripe. But if you just leave it alone, we have to decide, he said again. Decide what? How we're going to die. How we're going to do it. On the TV, they were showing a segment about the Dalmatians, crews of women and teenagers who made lunches and cupcakes for the volunteer fire crews. I'm not going to kill myself, Harper said. I've told you that already. I've got this baby in me. I mean to see it born. I can deliver by C-section next March. March? It's September. You'll be cinders by March, or target practice for a cremation squad. You want to die like those people in the field? No, Harper said quietly. I know what you did to me, he said. He drew a shuddering, effortful breath. I know. I keep getting hot patches on my arms and legs. I love that you made your work so socially conscious, that you were so connected to community, even if it was always just this thing you did to satisfy your own narcissism. You needed to surround yourself with crying kids because of the good feeling it gives you about yourself when you wipe away their tears. There are no unselfish acts. When people do something for someone else, it's always for their own personal psychological reasons. But I'm still a little sick to see how fixated you are on your own needs. You don't even care how many people you spread it to, as long as nothing uproots you from your delusion of saving one more child. He was trying to get a fight out of her. Wanted to push her into saying things she didn't want to say. She tacked in another direction. These hot patches, I haven't heard of that. That's not a symptom of... That's not your symptom. It's mine. Don't pretend you're a fucking doctor. A fucking master's in nursing and 3 years of working at an elementary school doesn't make you Dr. Motherfucking House. You wipe a real doctor's sweat off his upper lip when he's performing surgery. And shake his prick when he's done taking a leak. Maybe you should come home. I can examine you without touching you. Maybe I can reassure you. I am going to wait, he said, until I am sure. And then I am coming home. And you need to be there, because you promised. Jacob, she said again, but he was gone. October 11. The power went out again one hot, smoky morning, a few days after her last call from Jacob, and this time it didn't come back. By then, Harper was down to the last cans from the back of the cupboard, the ones with dust on them that she couldn't remember buying. She hadn't been out of the house since the day before she found the first stripe on her leg. She didn't dare. Maybe she could cover up. She didn't have the scale on her face or hands, but her heart quailed at the thought of bumping into someone in the corner store and accidentally sentencing them to death. One part of her wondered if she could eat Crisco. Another part of her knew she could, and soon would. She had saved a little cocoa powder, hoping she could make it taste like chocolate pudding. There was no single moment when she thought to herself, "I am going." There was no hour of steely-eyed decision when she realized soon she would be out of food and have to start taking chances. One day, though, she unstrung clothes from the line across the back deck and began to make a pile on the bed next to the portable mother. At first it was just a collection of things she meant to put away, some T-shirts, a pair of jeans, her sweats. But it also looked like a stack of things she might take with her if she were packing the car to go elsewhere. When she opened the dresser, she found herself picking things out instead of putting them away. There was no destination, no plan, almost no thought at all. She operated on no more than the half-formed notion that it might be smart to have some things in her old carpet bag in case she had to leave the house in a hurry. Mostly she was zoned out, gliding along with no more intention or purpose than a leaf blown about by a restless fall breeze. She had the radio on, a violently pink Hello Kitty boombox that ran on D-cells, and she folded clothes to the classic rock radio station, Tom Petty and Bob Seger supplying the sonic equivalent of wallpaper. At some point, though, her consciousness settled back into the moment, and she realized the music had stopped. The DJ was belting out a monologue, and had been at it for a while. She recognized his voice, a hoarsened, raspy bass that belonged to a former morning show joker. Or had he been a right-wing radio host? She couldn't recall, and she couldn't remember his real name, either. When he referred to himself, which he did frequently, it was as the Marlboro Man, on account of all the burners he had smoked. That was what he called people sick with dragon scale. Burners. He boomed with a certain crass authority that the former president was blacker than he used to be, since he had cooked to death from dragon scale. He said when he went off the air he would be out with a cremation crew, chasing burners out of their hidey holes and lighting them up. Harper sat on the bed and listened with repulsed fascination while he told a story about forcing three girls to take their shirts off to prove they didn't have dragon scale on their boobies. "Healthy American boobies, that's what we're fighting for," he said. "That needs to be in the Constitution. Every man has a right to life, liberty, and germ-free titties. Learn the drill, girls. If we show up at your front door, be ready to do your patriotic duty and show us your freedom-loving, virus-free knockers." The knocker crashed at the front door, and Harper jumped as if a cremation crew were kicking it in. The sound was, in a way, more startling than someone screaming in the street or a fire siren. She heard people screaming every day and sirens every hour. She could not remember the last time someone had knocked on the door. She padded down the hall and looked through the peephole. Tony the Tiger and Captain America stood together on the front step, holding wrinkled plastic bags. Beyond them, down at the end of the drive, a man sat with his back to the house, smoking a cigarette, a tendril of smoke rising from his head. "Trick and treat," came a muffled voice, a girl's voice. "Trick or—" Harper started, then stopped. "It's not Halloween. We're getting an early start." It offended her, some idiot sending his kids house to house in the middle of a plague. She had stern ideas about parenting, and such behavior fell well short of her standards. It riled up her inner English nanny and made her want to stab the offending grown-up in the eye with an umbrella. Harper picked her windbreaker off the hook and slipped it on to cover the pretty scrollwork of dragon scale scrawled on her arms. She opened the door but left it on the chain and peered out through the 6-inch gap. The girl might have been as old as 18 or as young as 13. With her face hidden behind her Captain America mask, it was impossible to tell. Her head was shaved, and if Harper hadn't heard her voice, she would have taken her for a boy. Her brother was possibly just half her age. The eyes that peered out through the holes in his Tony the Tiger mask were very pale, the light green of an empty Coke bottle. "Trick and treat," Captain America said again. A gold locket shaped like a hardcover book, hung outside her moth-eaten turtleneck. "You shouldn't be knocking on doors for candy." She looked past them to the man smoking a cigarette on the curb with his back to the house. "Is that your father?" "We aren't here to get a treat," Captain America told her. "We're here to give you one. And we've got tricks, too. You can have one of each. That's why it's trick and treat. We thought it would cheer people up." "You still shouldn't be out. People are sick. If someone sick touches someone who isn't, they can give you the bad thing they've got." She raised her voice and yelled past them. "Hey, buddy! These kids shouldn't be out! There's a contagion on!" "We're wearing gloves," Captain America told her. "And we won't touch you. No one is going to catch anything from anyone. I promise. Sanitation is our number one priority. Don't you want to see your treat?" She jabbed the boy with her elbow. The tiger held open his bag. There was a bottle of sugared gummy vitamins in there. Prenatal vitamins, she saw. Harper snapped her head up, eyeing one child and then the other. "What is this?" "They're like Sour Patch Kids," said Captain America. "But you can only take two a day. Are you all right?" "What do you mean, am I all right?" "Hang on a minute. Who are you? I think I want to talk to your father." She lifted herself on tiptoes and hollered over their heads. "I want to talk to you!" The man sitting on the curb didn't look at her, just waved one hand in a sleepy, dismissive gesture. Or maybe he was fanning the smoke away from his face. He blew a trickle of smoke rings into the afternoon. Captain America cast a casual glance over her shoulder at the man on the curb. "That's not our father. Our father isn't with us." Harper dropped her gaze. The boy was still holding the bag open for her to inspect his offering. "These are prenatal vitamins. How do you know I'm pregnant? I don't look pregnant." "Wait, do I?" Captain America said. "Not yet." "Who sent you here? Who told you to give this to me? Don't you want them? If you don't want them, you don't have to take them." "It's not about whether I want them. You're very kind, and I would, but take them then." The boy hung the bag on the doorknob and stepped back. After a moment, Harper reached through the gap and slipped the bag into the house. "Now have a trick," the girl said, and held her own bag open so Harper could see what was inside. Tony the Tiger didn't seem to have anything to say. He never made a sound. Harper looked into the bag. There was a slide whistle in it, in plastic wrap. "They're really loud," said Captain America. "You can hear it all the way from here to Wentworth by the sea. A deaf person could hear it. Take it." "There's nothing else in the bag," Harper said. "You don't have any other tricks to hand out. You're our last stop." Harper wondered for the first time if she might be dreaming. It felt like the kind of conversation that occurred in a dream. The children in their masks seemed like more than children. They seemed like symbols. When the girl spoke, it felt like she was talking in a secret dream code. A psychologist could spend hours trying to puzzle it out. And the boy just stood there staring at her. He never blinked. When Harper spoke, he stared at her lips like he wanted to kiss her. She felt a brief but almost painful stab of hope. Maybe all of it was a dream. Maybe she had a bad case of flu, or something worse than flu, and everything that had happened in the last 3 months was a vision inspired by sickness. Wasn't this exactly the kind of thing a person would dream if they were on fire with a fever? Perhaps she was only dreaming Jacob had left her, and that she was alone in an infected world, a world that was burning, and her only visitors in weeks were a pair of masked children who spoke in fortune cookie messages. "I will take the whistle," Harper thought. "And if I blow it hard, my fever will break, and I will wake up in bed, covered in sweat, with Jacob pressing a cool washcloth to my forehead." The girl hung her bag from the doorknob and stepped away. Harper took it, clutched the crinkling plastic to her chest. "Are you sure you're all right?" the girl asked. "Do you need anything? I mean, besides your trick and your treat? You don't come outside anymore." "How do you know I don't come outside anymore? How long have you been watching me? I don't know what you're up to, but I don't like games. Not unless I know who I'm playing with." She looked past them, elevated herself onto her tiptoes once more, and shouted at the man sitting on the curb with his back to her. "I don't like games, buddy boy." "You're all right," Captain America said, in a confident, assertive tone. "If you need anything, just call."
"Call?" Harper asked.
"How am I supposed to call? I don't even know who you are."
"That's all right. We know who you are," Captain America said, and gripped the little boy by the shoulder and turned him away.
They walked swiftly down the path toward the street. As they reached the curb, the man sitting there pushed himself to his feet, and for the first time Harper saw he wasn't smoking a cigarette. He was just smoking. He blew a last mouthful of cloud, which disintegrated into 100 small butterflies of smoke. They scattered, flapping frantically away into the smoggy morning. Harper slammed the door, yanked the chain off, threw the door open wide, took 3 wreathing steps into the yard. "Hey!" she shouted, her heart clouding against the inside of her chest, as if she had just run a few laps around the house. The guy looked back over his shoulder at her, and she saw he was wearing a Hillary Clinton mask. For the first time, she noticed he was wearing slightly reflective yellow pants, like the sort firemen wore. "Hey! Come back here!" she yelled. The man walked the children swiftly away down the sidewalk, disappearing behind a hedge. The boy was practically skipping. Harper crossed the yellowing grass, still clutching the bag with the slide whistle in it. She reached the sidewalk and looked around for them, blinking in the haze that drifted perpetually along the street. It was thicker than usual today, a pale mass that gradually erased the road so that she couldn't see to the end of the block. The smoke swallowed houses, lawns, telephone poles, and the sky itself. It had swallowed the man and his children, too. Harper stared after them, eyes watering. When Harper was back in her house, she put the chain on the door again. If a quarantine patrol showed up, that chain might buy her enough time to get down into the basement, out the back door, and into the woods, with her carpet bag and her slide whistle. She was turning the whistle over in her hands, wondering how loud it was, when she realized the house had gone perfectly still. No music, and no Marlboro man. Somewhere in the last few minutes, the batteries had died in her Hello Kitty radio. The 21st century, like her masked visitors, had briskly and unapologetically slipped away from her, leaving her all on her own again. Trick and treat, she thought. 12. When her cell phone was close to dead, she knew it was time to make the call she had been putting off, that if she waited one more day, she might not be able to make the call at all. She had a glass of white wine to loosen herself up, and she rang her brother. Her sister-in-law, Lindy, answered. In her early 20s, Lindy had parlayed her hobby of fucking the bassists in second-string rock bands into a job at a recording studio in Woodstock, which was what she was doing when she met Connor. He was playing bass for a prog metal band called Unbreakable. They weren't. Connor wound up with a bald spot the size of a tea saucer and a job installing hot tubs. Lindy became an instructor at an upscale gym, where she taught aerobic pole dancing to housewives, which she likened to being an animal trainer working with walruses. "You want to throw sardines at them just for turning in a complete circle without falling down." Not long afterward, Harper let her own gym membership lapse. She couldn't stop worrying about what the trainer said about her in private. "How are you, Lindy?" Harper asked. "I don't know. I have a 3-year-old. I'm too tired to think about how I'm doing. Ask me again in 20 years, if any of us are still around then." "You must want Khan." She lowered the phone and screamed, "Khan, the sis!" Connor picked up. "Hey, it's the sis. What's up?"
"I've got big news," she said.
"Is it the monk? The monk in London?"
"No. What monk?"
"The one they shot trying to walk into the BBC. You don't know about the monk?"
"Him and 3 others.
They were all sick. Long-term sick. This monk has been walking around with spores since February. They think he might have infected literally thousands. They think he wanted to infect the newsroom staff to make a political point. Terrorism by way of disease. Crazy motherfucker. He was glowing like a light bulb when they cut him down. It's not a disease, you know, not in the traditional sense. It's not a germ. It's a spore.
Uh-huh.
They talked to his followers when they rounded them up. He was telling them they could learn to control the infection and not to infect others, that they could go home, live among normal people. And if they did infect someone they loved, well, they could just teach them how not to be sick, too. He probably had a brain full of spore. You had some patients like that in the hospital, didn't you? Crazies with spore all over their brain?
It gets all over the brain, but I don't know if that's why some people go crazy after they're infected.
Hearing you could explode into flames at any second will put a lot of mental strain on a person. Maybe the real surprise is that anyone stays sane. She thought she would know pretty soon if the scale had any effect on a person's mental state. It was probably beginning to coat her brain right now.
Is there something happening besides the terrorist monk? Connor asked.
She said, I'm pregnant.
You're, he said. Oh my God, Harpo! Oh my God! Lindy! Lindy! Harpo and Jake got pregnant!
In the background, Harper heard Lindy say, she's pregnant, in a flat tone that carried no note of celebration. Then she said something else in a lower tone. It sounded like a question.
Harpo,
Connor said. He was trying to sound joyous, but she heard the strain in his voice, and she knew Lindy was being unpleasant somehow.
I'm so, so happy for you. We didn't even know you were trying. We thought...
In the background, but perfectly audible, Lindy said,
we thought you'd be crazy to get pregnant in the middle of a plague after you spent months in constant contact with infectious people.
Do Mom and Dad know? Connor asked, his voice flustered. Then, before she could answer, he said, hang on. She heard him press the phone to his chest to muffle it, something she had seen him do dozens of times. She waited for him to come back to her. Finally, he did.
Hey, he said, out of breath, as if he had just run up a flight of stairs. Maybe he had jogged upstairs to get away from Lindy.
Where were we? I'm so happy for you. Do you know the sex?
It's too early for that.
She took a deep breath and said, what would you think if I came to visit for a while?
I think I would try to talk you out of it. You don't want to go on the road the way things are now. You can't go 30 miles without hitting a roadblock, and that's the least of what's out there. If something happened to you, I'd never forgive myself.
If I could come, though, speaking hypothetically, what would happen if I turned up on your doorstep tomorrow?
I would start with a hug, and we'd go from there. Is Jacob on board with this plan? Does he know a guy with a private plane or something? Put him on. I want to say congratulations.
I can't put him on. Jacob and I aren't living together anymore.
What do you mean you aren't? What happened? Connor asked.
He was silent for a moment. Then he said,
oh, Jesus. He's sick, isn't he? That's why you want to come. Jesus, I knew you were being weird, but I thought, why, you're pregnant. You're entitled.
I don't know if he's sick, she said softly. But I am.
That's the bad news, Connor. I came down with it 6 weeks ago. If I turned up on your doorstep, the last thing you'd want to do is hug me.
What do you mean? His voice sounded small and frightened.
How?
I don't know. I was careful. It can't have happened in the hospital. They had us in rubber head to foot. She was again surprised at the calm she felt, staring the fact of her sickness in the face.
Connor, the womb isn't a good host for the spore. There's a strong chance the baby will be born healthy.
Hang on. Hang on, hang on. I mean, oh, God.
He sounded like he was trying not to cry.
You're just a kid. Why'd you have to work in that hospital? Why'd you have to fucking go in there?
They needed nurses. That's what I am.
Connor.
I could live with this for months.
Months.
Long enough to have the baby by C-section. I want you and Lindy to have him after I'm gone.
The thought of Lindy being mother to her unborn child was a bad one, but she forced herself not to think about it.
Connor, at least, would be a good dad, loving and patient and funny and a bit square, and her child would have the portable mother for the tough times.
Harper, Harper, I'm sorry. His voice was strained and close to a whisper.
It's not fair.
All you ever are is nice to people. It's just not fair. Shh, shh, Connor. This baby is going to need you, and I'm going to need you. Yeah, no. I mean, wouldn't it be better if you went to a hospital? I can't. I don't know what it's like in New York, but here in New Hampshire they're sending the sick to a quarantine camp in Concord. It's not a good place. There's no medical treatment there. Even if the baby lives, I don't know what they'll do with him, where they'll place him. I want the baby to be with you, Connor. You and Lindy. Just saying Lindy's name was hard. Besides, people with the spore, when they congregate, they sometimes set each other off. We know that now. We saw it in the hospital. Going to a camp crowded with other people who have this thing is a death sentence. For me, and probably the baby, too. So what about our baby, Harper? Said Lindy, her voice sharp and loud in Harper's ear. She had picked up an extension. I'm sorry. I'm so fucking sorry I feel ill. I can't imagine what you're going through. But, Harper, we have a 3-year-old, and you want us to hide you? You want us to take you in and risk you passing this infection to our child? To us? I could stay in your garage, Harper whispered, but she doubted Lindy heard her. Even if you don't pass it to us, what happens if someone finds out? What happens to Connor? To me? They're locking people up, Harper. We're probably breaking 6 federal laws even talking about this, Lindy said. Connor said, Lindy, get off the phone. Let me talk to my sister. I am not getting off the phone. You are not making this decision without me. I am not going to let her talk you into risking all of our lives. You want to see our fucking little boy burn to death? No. No. Not happening. Lindy, this is a private conversation, Connor said. Whined, really. This business is between me and Harp. When it comes to decisions that could affect the safety of our child, it stops being private business and starts being Lindy business, she said. I would risk my life for either one of you, but I will not risk my son's life. And it isn't right to ask me to. Being a hero isn't an option anymore when you have a little kid. I know it, and Harper, you know it too. If you didn't know it before you got pregnant, you know it now. You want your baby to be okay. I understand, because I feel the same way about mine. I am sorry, Harper, I am. But you made your choices. We have to make ours. They aren't heroic choices, but they'll keep our little boy alive until this is all over. Lindy, Connor pleaded, although what he was pleading for, Harper couldn't guess. Because Lindy was awful, an awful person. Someone who liked being a mother because it gave her a child and a husband to bully. Everything about her was horrible, from her pointy nose to her pointed little tits to her pointed shrill voice. But she was right. Harper was a loaded gun now, and you didn't leave a loaded gun where a child could come across it. The thought crossed Harper's mind, not for the first time. The choosing to try to live was, in some ways, a monstrous act, an act of towering, possibly homicidal selfishness. Her death was a certainty now, and she felt everything depended on not taking anyone else with her and not putting anyone at risk. But someone is already at risk. The baby is at risk. Harper shut her eyes. A pair of candles burned on the coffee table, and she could dimly apprehend their light through her eyelids, a sickly red glow. Connor, Harper said. Lindy is right. I wasn't thinking. I'm just scared. Of course you are, Lindy said. Oh, of course you are, Harper. It was wrong to ask. I've been knocking around by myself for too long. Jacob left last month so he wouldn't get it, too. You spend too much time alone, you can talk yourself into some really rotten ideas. You ought to call your father, Lindy said. Fill him in on what's happening. What? Connor cried. Jesus, Dad can't know about this. It'll kill him. He had a heart attack last year, Lindy. You want him to have another? He's a smart man. He might have some ideas. Besides, your parents have a right to know. Harper ought to be the one to explain to them the situation she's put us all in. Connor was sputtering. If it doesn't stop his heart, it'll break it. Lindy. Lindy! You might be right, Lindy, Harper said. You're the most practical of any of us. I might have to call Mom and Dad at some point, but not tonight. I've only got 3% charge left on my phone, and I don't want to give them the bad news and then get disconnected. I want you to promise you'll let me tell them. I don't want them to hear it from you and not be able to get in touch with me. Besides, like you said, I made this situation. I'm the one who has to bear the responsibility. Harper didn't have any intention of calling her parents and telling them she would likely be dead within a year. There would be no good in it. They were in their late 60s, stranded in God's waiting room, a.k.a. Florida. They couldn't help her from there, and they couldn't come to her. All they could do was get an early start on mourning her, and Harper didn't see the point. Nothing mollified Lindy faster than someone telling her she was right, however. And when she spoke again, a kind of hushed calm had come into her voice. Of course I'll let you be the one to tell them. You speak to them when you can and when you're ready. If they need someone to talk to, we'll do what we can to comfort them from our end. In a distraught, distracted voice, she added, Maybe this is the thing that will finally bring your mother and me together. There was a silver lining, Harper thought. Maybe she was going to burn to death, but at least it would give Lindy a chance to bond with her mother-in-law. Lindy, Connor, my phone is about to die and I don't know when I'll be able to call again. I haven't had power in the house for days. Can I say goodnight to Connor, Jr.? It must almost be his bedtime. Ah, Harper, Connor said. I don't know. Of course she can say goodnight to him, Lindy said, on Harper's side now. Harp, you aren't going to tell the little guy you're sick, are you? Of course she won't, Lindy said. I don't think you should tell him about the baby, either. I don't want him to get the idea in his head that he's going to have a... Jesus, Harper, this is really hard. He sounded like he was trying not to cry. I want to put my arms around you, sis. She said, I love you, Con. Because whatever Jacob believed about those three words, they still mattered to Harper. They were as close to an incantation as any she knew had power other words lacked. I'll put Junior on, Lindy said, her voice gentle, hushed, as if she were speaking in a church. There was a plasticky clatter as she put her extension down. Her brother said, Don't be mad. Don't hate us, Harper. He was speaking in a whisper, too, his voice hitching with grief. I would never, she said to her brother. You have to take care of each other. What Lindy said is just right. You're doing the right thing. Oh, Harp, Connor said. He inhaled deeply, a wet, choked breath, and said, Here comes the kid. There followed a moment of silence as he passed the phone over. Perhaps because it was so quiet, Harper caught a noise in the street, the gravelly rumble and crash of a big truck moving along the road. She was unused to hearing traffic after dark these days. There was a curfew. Connor Jr. said, Hi, Harper, bringing her thoughts back to the world on the other end of the line. Hi, Connor Jr. Daddy is crying. He says he hit his head on something. You have to give him a kiss and make it better. Okay. Are you crying? Why are you crying, too? Did you hit your head? Yes. Everyone is hitting their head. It's that kind of night. Something thumped. Connor Jr. cried, I just hit my head. Don't do that, Harper said. Harper noticed in a distracted, half-conscious way that the big truck she had heard earlier was still out in the street, still rumbling. The thump thumped again. I hit my head again, Connor Jr. said happily. We all hit our heads. No more, Harper said. You'll give yourself a headache. I did give myself a headache, he announced with great cheer. She kissed the phone with a loud, wet smack. I kissed the phone. Did you feel it? Uh-huh, I did. Thank you. I feel better already. Good, she said. The knocker slammed on the front door. Harper came up off the couch, as startled as if she had heard a shot in the street. Did you just thump your head again? Connor asked. I heard you thump it real hard. Harper took a step toward the front hall. The thought was in her that she was walking in the wrong direction. She ought to be headed for the bedroom to get her carpet bag. She couldn't think of a single person who might be at the door this time of the evening that she would want to see. Do you want a kiss to make it better? Connor said. Sure. A kiss to make it better, and a kiss goodnight, she said. She heard a damp smooch, and then in a soft, almost shy tone, Connor said, There, that should do it.
It did.
I have to go now. I gotta brush my teeth. Then I get my story.
Go have your story, Connor Jr., she said.
Good night.
Out in the hall, she heard a sound she didn't recognize. A rattling, rasping click and clack. A muted bang. She waited for Connor to say goodnight back to her, but he never did. And at last it came to her that there was something different about the silence on the other end of the line. When she lowered her phone, she discovered it was dead, had lost the last of its charge. It was just a paperweight now. The raspy click-clack-bang came once more. Harper stepped into the front hall but held up, 2 yards from the door, listening to the stillness. Hello? She asked. The door opened 4 inches before the chain caught it with another loud, rattly bang. Jacob peered through the open space into the hallway.
Harper, he said. Hey, wanna let me in? I wanna talk.
13. She stood just beyond the entrance to the den, looking down the hall at the piece of Jacob she could see through the gap between door and frame. He had a 4-day growth on his long, hollow-eyed face. They had talked, the way people do, about who would play them in the movie version of their lives. Why anyone would want to make a movie about an elementary school nurse and a man who answered phones for the Public Works Department was another question. She had thought Jason Patrick, or maybe young Johnny Depp for him. Someone dark and wiry, who looked like he could do a handstand, and who might occasionally write poetry. Right now, he looked like Jason Patrick or Johnny Depp in a movie about heroin addiction. His face was damp with sweat, and his eyes glittered with a fever brightness. Casting Harper had been easier. Julie Andrews, obviously. Julie Andrews at 28, not because they looked anything alike, but because Harper wouldn't consider anyone else for the part. If they couldn't get Julie Andrews at 28, then they'd just have to call the movie off. He had not come home on his bike. Beyond him, idling alongside the curb, was one of the town trucks, a pumpkin-colored 2.5-ton freight liner with a big snowwing plow on the front, battered and blackened from hard use. They had kept the plows running day and night, clearing wreckage out of the roads. There was always a car burning somewhere that had to be moved. She started down the hallway, hugging herself. The air coming through the open slot of the door was cool and smelled of fall, that spicy sweet odor of apples and crushed autumn leaves and distant smoke. Always smoke.
You should have called, she said. I didn't know you were coming over. I was going to sleep soon. I probably wouldn't have heard you.
I would have got in somehow. Kicked a window in.
I'm glad you didn't. There's no oil in the boiler. It's hard enough keeping this house warm without windows bashed in. It's getting cold out there.
You aren't kidding. Want to let me in?
She didn't much care to answer that question, not even to herself. Harper wished he had come during the day. She could readily imagine unthreading the chain for him on a bright, sunny afternoon. But with the October darkness behind him, and the October chill coming through the gap between door and frame, it was impossible not to think about the last time they talked, and how he had made coming home sound like a threat. She pushed out a deep breath and said,
How are you?
Better. A lot better, Harp. I'm sorry I freaked you out.
He gave her a hangdog look from beneath his long, almost girlish eyelashes.
What about the spore? You were worried you were infected. Have you seen any other marks on you?
No. Nope. I panicked. I lost it. No excuses. I'm all right. Except for an incurable case of shame. You've got the dragon scale, but I'm the one who has been acting like...
He looked away, back toward his freightliner, then said, Shit.
Should I go? Come back tomorrow? I just wanted to talk about stuff. I was overcome with a sudden late-night desire to convince my wife I'm not a hysterical piece of shit.
I want to talk, too. I think we need to.
Right? He said. About the baby? If we're going to do this thing, If we're going to have this kid, we're going to need a plan. Next March is a long way off. You want to unlock this gun, though? I'm cold.
Hang on, she said. She pushed the door shut and put her hand on the chain. She slid it down the slot to the open hole, then caught herself, playing back what he had just said. She had misheard him, she thought. Her ears had played a trick on her.
Jacob, she said, holding the chain in place, did you say something about a gun?
What? No. No. I don't...
Would you let me in? I'm freezing my narrow little ass off out here.
She looked through the peephole. He stood very close to it, so she could only see his right ear, part of his face. Jacob, she said, you're scaring me a little. Will you show me your hands?
Okay. I think you're the one being paranoid now, but okay. Now watch. Here are my hands.
He took a step back from the door and held out his hands to either side of his body. His left foot shot up and into the door. The chain flew loose. The door smashed her in the face and drove her stumbling back and down onto her ass. His right hand came up with the gun, a small revolver, pulling it from one deep pocket of his track pants. He did not point it at her. He stepped in through the door and elbowed it shut behind him.
I want things to be nice, he said.
He held his free hand up, palm out, in a placating gesture. She got up on all fours and started to scramble away, trying to stand.
Stop, he said.
She didn't stop. She thought she could get around the corner and into the kitchen, make it down the stairs to the basement and out the back door. When she stood, though, he kicked the back of her left leg behind the knee, and she went down again.
Baby girl, stop, he said. Don't.
She rolled onto her side. He stood over her with the gun, giving her a perplexed look.
Stop, he repeated. I don't want it to be like this. I want things to be like we talked about. I want things to be nice.
She began to crawl again. When he took a step toward her, she grabbed at the side table, the one with the driftwood lamp on it, and twisted it, trying to throw it at him. He batted it aside, hardly glanced at it, his gaze fixed on her.
Please, he said. I don't want to hurt you. The thought makes me sick.
He reached out with his left hand, offering to help her up. When she didn't take it, he bent forward and grabbed her upper arm and dragged her to her feet. She struggled to pull loose, but he yanked her off balance so she fell against him, into his chest. Then he wrapped her in an embrace, holding her against him.
Please, he said, rocking back and forth with her. Please. I know you're scared. I'm scared, too. We have a right to be scared. We've both got this thing, and we're dying.
The gun was there, against the small of her back. Her shirt was hiked up, and she could feel cold metal against her spine.
I want it to be like we talked about. I want it to be nice. I want it to be good and easy. I don't want to go out desperate and scared and crying. And I don't want you to die that way, either. I adore you too much for that.
Don't touch me, she said. We don't know if you're sick. I don't want to pass it to you.
I know it. I know I have it. I know I'm going to die. We both are. It's just a matter of how.
He loosened his grip on her. He was kissing her. Sweetly. Devoutly. He kissed her hair. He kissed her forehead. When she shut her eyes, he kissed her eyelids, each one, and she shivered.
You shouldn't kiss me, she whispered.
How am I supposed to keep from kissing you? It was the sweetest thing I ever had.
She opened her eyes and looked into his face. Jacob, I can feel you're hot, but I don't see any marks on you. How can you be sure you're infected?
He shook his head. My hip. It started yesterday and it's got worse and worse. My whole hip is on fire.
Jacob had his right arm loosely around her waist, the gun grazing her spine. He reached up with his other hand and drew his knuckles along her cheek in a gentle, smoothing gesture. She shivered helplessly.
Let's go sit down.
Let's have it like we talked about. Let's have it nice, just like we both wanted.
14. He steered her into the den where, half a year before, they had sat together drinking white wine and watching people jump from the top of the Space Needle. He gripped her upper arm like he was preparing to disjoint it, twist it loose from her body the way a person might wrench a drumstick off a roast chicken. Then he seemed to realize he was hurting her, and he let go and slipped his palm, gently, almost tenderly, along her biceps. The shadows in the room shifted this way and that in the red candlelight. "Let's sit," said the shadow beside her, one among the many. "Let's talk." Jacob sank into his favorite chair, the Great Egg of Jacob. A chair made of wicker with an egg-shaped frame and a hole in the side, a cushion nestled within. He was a small man, and he could cross his legs Buddha-style and still fit himself entirely within the wicker teardrop. He put the gun in his lap. She perched on the edge of the coffee table to face him. "I want to look at your hip. I want to see the scale." "You want to tell me I don't have it, but I know I have it."
"Will you show me your hip?"
He paused, then stretched one leg out through the egg and rolled a little onto his side. Jacob pushed down the elastic waistband of his track pants to show her the hollow of his right hip, which was a bloody, abraded mess. The flesh was yellowish-black beneath a cross-hatching of deep scratches. It appalled her to look at it.
"Oh, Jacob, what did you do?
I told you, if you find a mark on you, leave it alone."
"I can't stand to look at it. I can't stand to have it on me. I don't know how you can bear it. I get a little nuts. I tried scraping it off with a razor."
He made a choked, ragged noise that could not quite pass for laughter. Harper narrowed her eyes, looking it over. "The scale calcifies into bright flecks. I don't see any flecks."
"It's yellow, all around the edges."
"That's bruise. That's just bruise. Jacob, is this the only mark on you?"
"On the inside of my knee. And an elbow. Don't ask to see them. I'm not here for a medical exam."
He turned to sit properly and allowed the waistband of his track pants to snap back into place.
"Are they all like that?" "I scratched them up the same. I got hysterical. I'm ashamed of that now, but it's true."
"I don't think that's dragon scale. I've seen a lot of it. I should know. And Jacob, you've been out of this house 6 weeks, almost seven. If you don't have it yet, that probably means..."
"It means you'll say anything to stop what happens next. I knew you'd try and tell me I wasn't sick. I could have scripted this entire conversation. You think I don't know what a burn feels like? It hurts all the time."
"It's infected, Jacob, but not with the trichophyton.
It's infected because you clawed yourself up and it hasn't been treated or dressed.
Jacob, please, you're healthy.
You should leave. You should go right now."
"Stop it.
Stop bargaining and stop lying. I don't want to hate you right now, but every time you tell me another lie to try and save yourself, I just want to shut you up."
"When was the last time you ate?"
"I don't know how you can even talk about food. Maybe I should just do it right now. This is awful. This isn't like we talked about. We talked about making love and having music and reading our favorite poems to each other. We talked about making it nice, a little party for two. But you're just scared, and if I didn't have this gun, you'd run away. You'd run and let me die by myself, without a shred of guilt about what you did to me, about passing it to me. That's the real reason you keep telling me I'm okay, I think. You're not just lying to me. You're lying to yourself. You can't face it, what you did."
His voice was serene, without the slightest trace of the hysteria she had heard when they talked on the phone. His gaze was serene, too. He watched her with the sort of glassy calm Harper associated with the mentally ill, people who sat on park benches chatting gaily with invisible friends. His newfound calm did not entirely surprise her. Terror was a fire that held you trapped in the top floor of a burning building. The only way to escape it was to jump. He had been building himself up to this last leap for weeks. She had heard it in his voice every time they talked on the phone, even if she didn't recognize it at the time. He had made his choice at last, and it had brought him the peace he was looking for. He was ready to go out the window. He wanted only to be holding her hand on the way down. What did surprise her was her own calm. She wondered at it. In the days before the earth began to burn, she had carried anxiety with her to work every morning and brought it home with her every night. A nameless, inconsiderate companion that had a habit of poking her in the ribs whenever she was trying to relax. And yet in those days there was nothing really to be anxious about. Her head would spin at the thought of defaulting on her student loans, of getting into another yelling match with her neighbor about his dog's habit of tearing open garbage and spreading it all over her lawn. And now she had a baby in her, and sickness crawling on her skin, and Jacob was crazy, sitting there watching her with his gun, and there was only this quiet readiness, which she irrationally believed had been waiting for her all her life. At the end, I get to be the person I always wanted to be, she thought. Is that really so terrible? She asked. Is it really so awful that I wanted to believe you didn't have it? I wanted you and the baby to make it. I wanted that more than I ever wanted anything, Jake. Something seemed to dim in his eyes. His shoulders drooped. Well, that was stupid. No one is going to make it. The whole world is toast, literally. The planet is going to be a cinder by the time we're done with it. Everyone is going to die. This is the last generation. I think we always knew that, even before Dragon Scale. We knew we were going to choke on our pollution and run out of food and air and all the rest of it. He could not resist lecturing her, even in the last minutes of her life. And it came to her then that she hadn't been in love with him for years. He was a tiresome know-it-all. This was followed by a second, startling notion that she wasn't quite ready to process, which was that she hadn't gone to work in the hospital hoping to be Florence Nightingale, no matter what he said. She had gone to work there because she wasn't interested in her own life anymore. She had never felt she was putting anything of great value at risk. This was followed by a slow throb of anger, which she felt as a hot prickle in her dragon scale. Jacob had done that to her. Plunged his philosophical syringe into her life and tried to suck all the simple happiness out of it. In a sense, he had been trying to kill her for years. She felt herself getting ready. She didn't even know for what. She was gathering her courage for some act that was as yet unclear to her, but which she felt was coming, rushing toward her. I read your book, she said. And there, she saw a flicker of something human, something besides his patient, beatific, dangerous calm. Behaviorists talked about micro-expressions, emotions that jumped to the surface, revealing all. In a flicker almost too fast to catch. For the briefest instant he regarded her with uncertainty and a blanch of discomfort. It was a wonder how much information could pass between two people in a single glance, without a word being said. He had, after all, really cheated on her with any number of their friends. That momentary look of shame was as good as a confession. "Pretty dirty, dude," she said. I was getting hot flashes that don't have anything to do with Dragon Scale. I asked you not to read it, he said. So shoot me. He made a harsh barking sound. It took her a moment to identify this noise as laughter. She exhaled again and threw her hands down and shook them as if they were wet and she were air-drying them. Whoo! All right. The world is going to have to burn out without us. I want something good before I go. He gave her a dull, hopeless look. Please, I'll try, she said. I'll try to make it nice. I don't know if it'll do any good. I'm not in the mood anymore. I think maybe I just want to get it over with. But I'm not ready. And you want it to feel right for me, don't you? Besides, I'm not going without getting laid once more. And she laughed and tried to smile. You've got no one to blame but yourself, Jacob Grayson. Leaving a bored and lonely woman all alone with that pile of shameless filth, gesturing with her head at the manuscript on the desk. He smiled himself, although it looked forced. Sex means more to you than it does to me. I know that turns a stereotype on its head. You really live in your body more than I do. It's one of the things I always found exciting about you.
But now, at the moment, I suppose I regard the sexual act with a certain amount of disgust.
She turned and crossed to the Hello Kitty boombox on the shelf. She had brought